Some things can become so much a part of our environment that we don't even notice them anymore. I grew up in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, about two or three blocks from the train station. Trains were a part of my early life, even though I've never ridden on one. We saw them often. The street on which I live actually crossed over a bridge, over the railroad tracks, over the train station. But I don't remember ever really hearing the trains. They came through at all times of day or night, but growing up there, I guess I learned not to hear them. They were just background noise that was part of my environment, something that my ears just automatically filtered out. Less than a block away from my home at 322 North Pennsylvania Avenue was the elementary and junior high school. For nearly half of my school years, I was able to leave home at about 10 minutes to 8, walk to school, and be in my seat before school started. It was wonderful. On top of that building, less than half a block away, and just about level with the upper windows in the large house in which we lived, were fire horns. Greensburg, Pennsylvania was served by a large and well-organized volunteer fire department, and when there was a fire, the horns blared out a signal that indicated the area in which the fire had occurred and which firehouse was supposed to respond to it. And again, growing up there, I just learned automatically to filter out the sound of those fire horns when they blew. Jeannie came home with me to meet my parents when we were both seniors at Bob Jones University, and the first morning that she was there, she asked me, "What did I hear last night?" And she told me that whatever it was, it just brought her straight up out of the bed. And I had never heard a thing, and I had trouble even figuring out what she was talking about. That fire horn that was so obvious to a stranger was so much a part of the environment that I grew up in that even after being away at Bob Jones University for 4 years, I didn't hear it. Now, that same thing can happen in our lives with certain sins. They can become so much a part of our environment as middle-class Americans that we don't even notice them anymore. To some degree, I believe that is happening with sexual immorality of all kinds. American Christians are becoming more and more accepting of it. I read a couple of startling statistics this week. Of Americans who regularly attend religious services, 23% say they're unsure whether living together outside of marriage is immoral. 1 in 4 aren't willing to condemn pornography as sin. Is it possible that Christians are becoming so acclimated to the sexualized environment in our culture that we don't notice that kind of sin anymore? Hopefully, that is not the case for those of us here this morning. Hopefully, through the preaching of the Word of God, hopefully, through the ministry of His Holy Spirit, He has kept our consciences awake in that area. But I am fearful that there is another sin that is so much a part of the fabric of American society that we may fail to even notice it in our lives. Sometimes we call it materialism. Our Bible versions normally label it covetousness. I think an even better translation is the simple word greed. Is it possible that greed is so respectable in our capitalistic culture, so accepted, so prevalent, so much the norm that we don't even notice it anymore? If so, then our Lord has words for us here in Luke 12 that will awaken us to the fire horn that is blaring, that will awaken us to the train that is rumbling, that will awaken us to the sin that has made itself so much at home in our lives. Let's read here in Luke 12, beginning in verse 13. Luke 12, beginning in verse 13. Then one from the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But Jesus said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater. And there I will store all my crops and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" Now, our text breaks nicely into two segments. In verses 13 through 15, as you can see there in your outline, Jesus introduces us to this topic of covetousness or greed. And then in verses 16 through 21, Jesus illustrates the consequences that greed can have in our lives. And he does that, as he did so often, by means of what we call a parable. It's really just a story. It's just an illustration. And we normally call this illustration the parable of the rich fool. Now, I said that Jesus introduces us to the topic of greed here in verses 13 through 15, but that's not completely accurate. Someone from the crowd really raised the topic. Look back with me in verse 1, and let's get a running start here into the context. Verse 1 tells us, "In the meantime, an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together so that they trampled one another." And then the rest of verse 1 indicates that Jesus addresses his remarks in verses 1 through 12 to his disciples. But apparently this huge throng overheard what Jesus was teaching to his disciples. And Jesus was teaching on the most serious matters, on those who can kill the body versus the eternal God who can kill the body and send to hell. On those who confess Jesus before men versus those who deny Jesus before men and whom he will deny before the Father. On persecution that will follow those who confess Jesus and how the Holy Spirit will help them. So in the middle of this teaching, on issues of life and death and eternity, this one from the crowd breaks in and asks Jesus to play an umpire between him and his brother in a dispute about an inheritance. Now, use a little bit of imagination. Can you really imagine this? I mean, it really would be no different than someone right now in this service standing up and saying, "Hey, preacher, can you help me with the problem? You got to help me get my inheritance from my brother. Can you imagine such a thing? That's what happened here. It's really just astounding, but it also gives us our first insight into greed. Greed can distract from the truly important. I mean, here we see a man so concerned about getting more of the things of this world that he cannot seem to hear what Jesus has to teach about eternity. Now we shake our heads until we realize that the same thing happens to us sometimes. We sit in church while the preacher speaks of eternal matters and we're wondering whether we can pay this bill or that bill at the end of the month. We wonder if our raise will be big enough so we can get a new car or whether Social Security will still be solvent when we retire. So get what I'm saying. Covetousness, greed, materialism, whatever you want to call it, so easily gets a hold of our heart that it can push the truly important out. Things about God, things about eternity, things about our spiritual condition. Our concern for money, our concern for stuff can be the ultimate distraction. It can give us a spiritual form of ADHD, attention deficit hyper greed disorder. And then Jesus' reply to this man in verse 14 points up a second truth about greed. Greed can cause interpersonal strife. Now, in an agrarian society like it was in those days in which Jesus walked the earth, most people made their living from the land on which they lived. And so an inheritance was particularly important. The means of making a living was the land that was handed down from one generation to the next. And it was common in Israel for sons to inherit jointly. Now, do you understand what that means? So if I inherit a fourth of a farm with my three brothers, then I've got a fourth of the property. But if I inherit jointly with my three brothers, all four of us own all of the farm. And there is no way to break it up. And that was done purposely. Because the land was the inheritance that God had given to Israel. And so this was a means of keeping the family inheritance together, of preserving it generation after generation. And so it's probable that this was one of the younger sons. His eldest brother would have been the one who was directing traffic back at the family farm. And basically he was coming to Jesus saying, I want them to lop off my part of the land so I can sell it and go get my money and do whatever I want. Who does this sound like? Jesus tells another parable about a guy like this, and we call him what? The prodigal son. This guy has a lot of the same shading, doesn't he? And Jesus refuses to be part of such a thing because the laws in regard to inheritance were part of the law of Moses. Often Jews appealed to a rabbi to help settle disputes about inheritance. But Jesus is no mere rabbi. His response to this man is abrupt, if not downright harsh. Jesus did not come to be a divider of men. He came to be a reconciler of men. Greed often divides, and Jesus will not help to divide this family. I mean, how often have disagreements over the terms of a will so torn members of a family apart that they never speak to one another again? I mean, Jesus was just spot on in this illustration. It's happened thousands of times down through the centuries. Greed, the desire for more, 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 has the ability to do that, and Jesus would not be part of it. What we see here in this account is a flesh and blood illustration of James chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Let me read that passage to you. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have, you murder and covet and cannot obtain. Interpersonal wars are often fueled by covetousness. Now, this exchange with this man causes Jesus to offer a clear warning in verse 15. He says, take heed and beware. And the word translated beware there means to be on your guard. And so the implication here is that greed is a positive spiritual danger to us. And the word that Jesus uses here in verse 15 points up that danger. It is the word that's commonly translated covetousness in our English versions, but the word means a desire for more, more, more. Greed is an insatiable desire for more, more, more. The great expositor of yesteryear, Alexander McLaren, illustrates the meaning of this word by asking us to think about someone with a great thirst who seeks to quench his thirst by drinking salt water. Perhaps he's shipwrecked, that's all he has to drink. Now that water, that salt water may quench his thirst for a moment, but ultimately it will only make him more thirsty. And if he continues to quench his thirst with salt water more and more and more, as he gets thirstier and thirstier and thirstier, ultimately it will kill him. And that's an apt illustration of greed. You see, what's counterintuitive to us as Americans, and this is what I mean by the fact that we've gotten used to this, when you find greed or covetousness in the pages of the New Testament, you find it in the worst possible neighborhood. It's always listed with murder and anger and idolatry and adultery. See, we don't tend to put it in that category, do we? But God puts it in that category. If we try to quench our thirst with the salt water of greed, we will find that ultimately it will be spiritually deadly to us. And so Jesus says, beware, be on your guard. Don't let this insinuate itself into your life. Then Jesus ends verse 15 with a proverb, a pithy statement that he wants to fasten onto our minds like Velcro. He says, one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. Will you repeat that with me? It's right there at the end of verse 15. One's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. One more time. One's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. And so greed is based on the wrong definition of life. And unfortunately, many Americans, including many evangelical Bible-believing Christians, subscribe to that wrong definition. Back in the 1980s, somebody put it this way: he who dies with the most toys wins. And that's how many Americans really play the game of life. You know, we live in the ultimate consumer culture. For many of us, the greatest thing ever invented is Amazon Prime. I mean, you can sit in your easy chair, and not only can you get more stuff, but it will be delivered right to your front door within 2 business days, and you can simply charge it with one click. What could be better? I want to tell you a story. It's a very American story. Much of the story I quote from a blog that I read called Intellectual Takeout, but you can find the same story in many places on the internet. I want to tell you this story because it's the best illustration of what I mean when I say that Americans, and you and I are Americans, Americans tend to live life based on the wrong definition of life. The story begins with Elizabeth Magie, M-A-G-I-E, born in 1866. Elizabeth was an outspoken rebel against the norms and the politics of her day. She was a feminist long before there was a feminist movement. And in addition to confronting gender politics, Maggie decided to take on the capitalist system of property owners. Her father was a liberal politician who firmly believed in the equal right of all men to the use of land. That's not quite socialism or communism, but it comes close. And he gave Elizabeth a book that greatly influenced her. And that book recommended that all landowners be taxed heavily simply for owning their land, and the proceeds then would be used for the benefit of all. And that way, land would benefit all citizens. And Maggie put these ideas into a board game that she invented and patented in 1904. She called it the Landlord's Game. Laid out on a board as a circuit, which was a novelty at the time, it was populated with streets and landmarks for sale. And the key innovation to her game lay in 2 sets of rules that she wrote for playing it. Under the prosperity set of rules, every player gained each time someone gained a property. And so what that was designed to do was to reflect the political view that taxing the value of land would benefit everyone. And the game was won by all when the player who had started out with the least money had doubled it. On the other hand, under the other set of rules, players got ahead by acquiring properties and collecting rent from all those who were unfortunate enough to land there, and whoever managed to bankrupt all of the rest emerged as the sole winner. Is this beginning to sound familiar? And the game was soon a hit among left-wing intellectuals on college campuses, including the Wharton School, Harvard, and Columbia, and also among the Quaker communities of that time. And some of these Quaker communities modified the rules, and they redrew the board with street names from Atlantic City. And among the players of this Quaker version was an unemployed man named Charles Darrow, who later sold this modified Quaker version to a games company called Parker Brothers. Now, once the game's true origins came to light, Parker Brothers bought up Maggie's patent, and then they relaunched this board game simply as Monopoly, with only one set of rules. And worse, they marketed along with the claim that the game's inventor was Darrow, who had dreamed it up in the 1930s during the Depression, sold it to Parker Brothers, and become a millionaire. None of which was true. It was a rags-to-riches fabrication that exemplified what Monopoly was really all about. And so the next time someone invites you to play a game of Monopoly, remember its history. That given a choice, Americans always opt for greed. Even in the games we play, it's all about whoever can get the most wins. Do you get it? You and me, we are infected with this virus and we don't even know it. I mean, think about it. Americans have more possessions than any nation or culture that has ever existed on the face of the earth. Now, we don't live in houses that are anywhere near as big as a palace in England or France. But think about it. We probably have near as much stuff as the kings and queens and dukes and duchesses that lived in those palaces. And yet we don't even seem to take that fact into account. We all have attitudes that are just so entitled. I mean, I'm an American. Of course I should live this way. And it really doesn't make any difference if I live above the median standard of living or below the median standard of living in this country. As far as comparison with other nations on earth, I am rich. But many of us, most of us, if not all of us, we don't think of it that way. Most of you, when I started preaching this morning, you thought, this isn't for me. I'm not rich. I'm not greedy. I'm not covetous. Wait just a minute. You sure? Remember, we're talking about the all-American sin here. Now, to impress this truth on the crowd who heard this exchange between Jesus and this man, Jesus told a parable, a story. And this little story illustrates the consequences of greed in our lives. Now, the story begins with a farmer whose fields yield a bumper crop. Now, the implication here is that God blessed this man with this wealth. Any Jew who heard Jesus that day would have inferred that fact. This just didn't happen. Every good and perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights. And that truth is important because it teaches us that wealth, having wealth, is not sinful in and of itself. It's not a sin to be an American. It's not a sin to have wealth. God called rich men like Job and Abraham good and godly. So as we begin this story, at this point, we have nothing more than a blessed individual. Now, to some degree, we would say that his riches were due to his own efforts. I mean, he plowed, he sowed, he reaped. But his riches were even more due to God's blessing on him. Remember what it says in 1 Corinthians 3? I planted, another watered, and God gives the increase. So God decided that this man should be rich. Now, before we go any further, let me make one point really clear. We, as Americans, we're the rich farmer. Right? Why do we have prosperity beyond any other nation on earth? Be careful. Is it because of our American ingenuity? Because we're smarter, harder working than anyone else? Be careful. I don't think so. It's because God Almighty has poured out His blessing on us in an unprecedented way. And so this rich farmer stands for us. This story may be about you and me. Now in verses 17 and 18, we see illustrated the first consequences of having too much. This farmer had to maintain and store his stuff. He didn't have enough room to store his bumper crop. The word that's translated barns here in verse 18 has more of the idea of a grain silo. You have to remember that wealth in that day was not ones and zeros in a bank computer somewhere. Wealth had to be stored. And so this man was wise. He built bigger and more grain silos to store and protect and maintain his wealth. And that's always the way it is with our stuff. I heard one pastor put it this way: do we possess our possessions, or do our possessions possess us? And here's part of what I mean. When we have so much stuff, then we are possessed of the worry of taking care of all that stuff, storing it, making sure it isn't stolen, making sure that it isn't ruined by weather. You know, you go out and you buy a nice car, so now what do you have to do? You got to insure the car, and you got to change the oil, and you got to wash it, and you got to vacuum it, and you've got to maintain it. And that's just one thing. On our way to church each week, we pass two developments. One of them, they've been working on it for several months, pushing dirt around, and about a week ago, they finally paved. The other one, they've just begun moving dirt. And they're big. You know what both of them are? Both of them, and they're about a mile apart. They're both storage units. Now, in 2017, in the United States of America, $300 million will be spent building storage units. That's three times what it was 10 years ago. And listen to this. On average, there is 10 square feet of storage. That's a 10 by 10 storage unit for every man, woman, boy, and girl in America. Let that sink in. Jesus teaches us here that our lives are not about stuff. But how can we really say that when we spend so much of our time and effort and money just storing and maintaining the stuff we've got? Starting to get it? Is it starting to come into focus? Then in verse 19, we get to the heart of the matter. We get to listen in on the still small voice in this farmer's heart. And here's what he says. That still small voice in his heart, he says, I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Now that one remark reveals this man's heart. And he has made three grave errors in regard to riches. First of all, I want you to notice the first word there in what he says to himself. It's the word soul. He speaks to his soul as if stuff could actually bring him contentment and peace and joy. Now that is an error that defines so many in our materialistic culture. And materialism is a good word for it. Materialism is that idea that material things, that which I can put my hands on, that which I can buy and possess, that is what will make me happy. And there are a lot of people in the American culture who invest their lives getting material things, thinking that's going to make them happy, and at the end of their lives they figure out, oops, I guess I was wrong. And too late, they figure out that they have traded what was really of value in their lives, that which really could have made them happy, for material possessions that could not. Then the second error becomes evident when we count up the number of first-person personal pronouns here in verses 17 through 19. The number of times he says, my and I. By my count, it comes to 10. Obviously, this man was a completely self-focused individual. He left God completely out of the picture. And God calls him a fool in verse 19. And a fool he was in the biblical sense, in the sense that that word is used in the book of Proverbs. A fool is someone who lives life as if God doesn't exist. And that is certainly a description of this man. Can you imagine, Christian, having the prosperity that we see described here and not thanking God for what he has done? I mean, I hope it's not hard, not difficult for you to imagine being in this man's shoes and saying something more like, bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits to me. And yet, let me remind you, we are this man. And how often do we thank God for all that he has poured out on us, just in a material way? When was the last time you got on your knees and said, bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, and began to tick them off and give thanks to God? I heard a statistic a few days ago. There are fewer poor people in the world today than at any time in human history. Less than 10%. That's the first time that poverty has dipped worldwide into single digits in recorded history. But you know how the level of poverty is defined? Those who live on less than $2 a day. That's less than $750 a year. You know what the median income is in the USA? I just read this week as well. It's just over $59,000 for a household. That's median household income. So you figure the average household has four in it. If the median household income is close to $60,000, then on average, an individual in the United States lives on close to $15,000 a year. That's 20 times as much as $750. And those are the kinds of numbers that ought to drive us to our knees and say, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. For all that God has given me." But the practical atheism of this man goes in another direction as well. When we leave God out of the picture, then we fail to understand that all that we have is a stewardship from Him. In the true and ultimate sense, you and I don't own anything. Folks, when you leave this life, I hate to tell you, you're not taking anything with you. And so all that we have is only lent to us by a God who expects us to manage it, who expects us to steward it for the benefit of His kingdom. And so again, if we have the right view, if God is really part of our view of all of the stuff that we have as Americans, all of the wealth that we have as Americans, then one of the questions we need to be asking is, what does God want me to do with all this stuff He has put in my possession? How can I maximize this for the benefit of His kingdom? And then related to this truth about stewardship is the final grave error that we see in this man's heart. He thought that all that God had given him was just to be focused on him and his desires alone. Not only did he leave God completely out of the picture, he also left anybody else completely out of the picture. He cared nothing for the needs of any other person than himself. You know, he could very well be the man that Jesus talks about in another one of his parables in Luke chapter 16, the rich man where Lazarus laid at his gate, wounded, dogs licking his sores, and he would do nothing about that. That's how this man's picture portrayed, in exactly the same kind of way. He didn't care about anyone but himself. And again, I remind you, we stand in this man's shoes. Does the greed in our hearts keep us from realizing that what God has entrusted to us is not just to be used for ourselves and our families and our desires? We're the richest people on earth. And God has given us this abundance so that we can minister to other human beings. As I indicated a moment ago, there are still many who remain in great need. It doesn't take looking very hard to find ways to minister to people in need around the world. Then in verse 20, the story takes an unexpected turn. All of this man's plans crumble to dust when God says to him, "Fool, this night your soul will be required of you." Here we see the worst error that this man made. He did not take the eternal view. Now, he was shrewd in preparing for the future, but he was shrewd in preparing for a future within the bounds of this life. He was completely unprepared for an eternal future. I love the way Jesus phrases this verse. In verse 19, this man says to himself, "Soul, take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." And here Jesus puts these words in God's mouth, "This night your soul will be required." We may be able to make our souls easy and merry in this life, but we have no control whatsoever over when our souls will be required. Now, Jesus goes on to draw two lessons from this man's complete ignorance of eternity. The first he puts again in the mouth of God himself. God asks at the end of verse 20, "Then whose will those things be which you have provided?" You know, often we lay up stuff, and in the end, when we have gone into eternity, it passes into the hands of others, and often they don't care about our stuff. Daughters don't like the china patterns that their mothers hand down to them. Sons don't collect the same stuff that their fathers did. My father collected bosun heads. Any of you know what bosuns are? About yay big. They're called chalk work. So they're molded chalk, exquisitely molded, hand painted. Very expensive. My father collected about 30 of them, and my son inherited them. They're probably worth between $1,500 and $2,000. You know where those bosun heads are? The rest of you Gerards back there, you can't tell. Okay? They're in my son's garage in a box. And you know what? It's not just that the stuff that we collect is unappreciated by our heirs. Some of it is a positive burden. Some of you are going to figure this out someday when your parents both die, and then you have to deal with the junk. Do you notice how it's changed from stuff to junk? The second lesson is really the conclusion here to the entire passage. It's the lesson that Jesus draws from the entire story. He says in verse 21, "So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." Jesus says that if we end up like this man, if we simply focus on laying up treasures for ourselves, then we will end up in the same sad condition as this farmer. He says we need to substitute another, more eternal goal. We must find ways to be rich toward God. Now, I like that phrase, rich toward God. First of all, I think it can mean the same thing that Jesus says elsewhere, that we must lay up treasure in heaven. That's true long-term retirement planning. And if your retirement planning doesn't include laying up treasure in heaven, then you have a very short-sighted retirement plan. So you and I need to build into our lives, as we manage all of the wealth and stuff that God has entrusted to us, we need to build into our lives being rich toward God. But this phrase may have a second meaning. The literal translation of these words is rich into God. And one of the modern versions actually uses the translation rich in relationship to God. I like that idea. See, here's the antidote to greed. Here's the antidote to covetousness. When you and I learn to be contented in our relationship with God, then greed won't be a problem. Who really satisfies the soul? This unwise farmer said, "Soul, take your ease. Take your ease in all of this stuff." And he had it completely wrong. Our souls were designed to take their ease in God alone, in a relationship with Him. And if that truly is the case, if we're truly finding the contentment and joy and peace that God intends for us to have in Him, then covetousness and greed won't be a problem. And then I close with one final point. It's really foundational to this final lesson that Jesus teaches us here. How can you lay up treasure in heaven if you're not sure you're going to heaven? How can you find contentment in a relationship with God if you're not certain you have a right relationship with God? You see, foundational to everything that Jesus is talking about here is having a relationship with God that comes only through what Jesus Christ did by His death, burial, and resurrection. We're all sinners. Our sin separates us from God. And if we die in that condition, that separation becomes eternal, in an eternal hell. But Jesus died to bear our sin, to take that sin out of the way that keeps us from having a right relationship with God. And so you and I can turn to Jesus. We can run to Jesus. We can put our faith in what He did in His death and His burial and His resurrection so that we can have a right relationship with God. Have you trusted Jesus to forgive your sin once and for all? Has he taken the sin problem out of the way for you because you personally have come to him and asked him to do that? Have you put your life in his hands? Because when you come to him, that's what's involved as well.